And thirdly, something which I will explain directly in Spanish because it refers to the last Spanish version of your book, which has been sold exceptionally in Girona because of this event. So, El Último Libro de Rorty, traducido por en Paidós, titulado Objetividad, Relativismo y Verdad, no ha salido todavía en las librerías, pero está en las librerías de Girona, se puede decir, estos días, porque Rorty está aquí. Y me dicen que vale 2.750 pesetas,
2.750 pesetas,
y que se puede encontrar en la librería universitaria, que es la que se encuentra cuando bajamos esta pendiente un poco fuerte de escaleras, a mano derecha, allí seguro que está, no sé si en algún otro sitio. Ah, sí, thank you.
Okay.
Making propaganda.
Much of this paper this afternoon is a sort of introduction to this introduction to McDowell's book. I do, again, urge you to read this because having read and written about the book, after I read the introduction, I felt much clearer about the book than when I'd simply read the book. It's a great help. And a lot of what I'll be reading consists of quotations from this introduction. McDowell's central notion is that of answerability to the world. He says, in this introduction, to make sense of a mental state or episodes being directed toward the world in the way in which, say, a belief in or judgment is, we need to put the state or episode in a normative context. A belief or judgment to the effect that things are thus and so must be a posture or stance that is correctly or incorrectly adopted according to whether or not things are indeed thus and so. This relation between mind and world is normative, then, in that thinking that aims at judgment or the fixation of belief is answerable to the world, to how things are, for whether or not it is correctly ascribed. Before going on, let me note that McDowell here does something that critics of the correspondence theory of truth have always complained about. He treats perceptual judgments as a model for all judgments. People who say truth is correspondence to reality say, you know, there are four chairs, and look, it corresponds. There are four chairs. You know, perception ties up with the notion of correspondence to reality in some obvious way. To say that this is red is directed to the world or answerable to the world is intuitively plausible. But such phrases seem less applicable if one's paradigm of a belief is, say, we ought to love one another, or there are many transfinite cardinals, or Proust was only an effete petit bourgeois. Another way of making the same point is to remark that there are vast areas of culture in which a belief or judgment that things are thus and so is indeed a posture or stance that is correctly or incorrectly applied, adopted, but in which it would be strange to say that it is correctly or incorrectly adopted according to whether things are indeed thus and so. That is, there are areas of culture where you can say, look, things are thus and so, perceptual judgments, and areas of culture that seem to sort of fade away from that end of the spectrum toward areas where, you know, you don't know where to point to say, look, things are thus and so. The addition of this latter phrase, whether things are indeed thus and so, may go unnoticed if one's paradigm of a belief or judgment is one of Newton's laws, but it will seem pointless when one is describing beliefs such as Blake is a better role model for poets than Byron, or Heidegger's philosophy was better than his politics. In art, morals, and politics, we want to judge correctly, but talk of world directedness and of things indeed being thus and so sounds hollow. At least it sounds that way to me. This point recalls one of the differences between the sort of Anglophone philosophy which harks back to Bacon and Locke and philosophical traditions which regard Anglophone empiricism as a notable example of cultural lag. When Anglophone philosophers think of a cultural achievement, a triumph of the human intellect, they typically think first of modern physical science, the saga that links Newton to Gell-Mann. Non-Anglophone philosophers may as easily think first of the European novel from Cervantes to Nabokov, or of socialist politics from Fourier to Helmut Schmidt. For these philosophers are more inclined than their Anglophone colleagues to follow Nietzsche's advice and to, as Nietzsche said, look at science through the optic of art and at art through that of life. Philosophers who take this Nietzschean advice will find Brandom's book more attractive than McDowell's, for Brandom is content to think of normativity, of the possibility of correctness and incorrectness in terms of human beings' answerability to one another. As I was suggesting at the end of my morning lecture, Brandom could probably say everything he needs to say about objectivity, about the possibility that any given judgment we make, no matter how unanimously, could be wrong, without talking about answerability to the world or world-directedness. Brandom's account of objectivity works just as well for mathematics as for physics, or as well for literary criticism as for chemistry. The primacy of perception and of natural science becomes explicit when McDowell goes on to say, again in the introduction, quote, even if we take it that answerability to how things are includes more than answerability to the empirical world, it nevertheless seems right to say this, since our cognitive predicament is that we confront the world by way of sensible intuition, to put it in Kantian terms, our reflection on the very idea of thought's directedness at how things are must begin with answerability to the empirical world. When discussing literature or politics, it's a bit strange to say that we're in a cognitive predicament. It's even more strange to say that this predicament is caused by the need to confront the world by way of sensible intuition. McDowell's choice of Kantian terms is a choice of visual metaphors, metaphors which Kant used to lament our lack of the faculty of intellectual intuition, which Aristotle had described over-optimistically in De Anima. It's also a choice of natural science as the paradigm of rational inquiry, a Kantian choice which Hegel explicitly repudiates. When one switches from Kant to Hegel, the philosopher whom Sellars described as the great foe of immediacy, these metaphors lose much of their appeal. So it's not surprising that it is among Anglophone philosophers who read far more Kant than they do Hegel that these metaphors should remain most prevalent. From a Sellarsian, Davidson, Brandomian, or Hegelian viewpoint, there's no clear need for what McDowell describes as, quote, a minimal empiricism, the idea that experience must constitute a tribunal mediating the way our thinking is answerable to how things are, as it must be if we are to make sense of it as thinking at all. For Sellars, Davidson, and Brandom, we're constantly interacting with things as well as with persons, and one of the ways in which we interact with both is through their effects upon our sensory organs. But none of these three philosophers need the notion of experience as a mediating tribunal. They can be content with an account of the world as exerting control on our inquiries in a merely causal way, rather than as exerting what McDowell calls rational control. What McDowell says of Davidson is true of Sellars and Brandom as well. All three think, quote, a merely causal, not rational linkage between thinking and independent reality will do, as interpretation of the idea that empirical content requires friction against something external to thinking, close quotes. That such an account will not do is, as far as I can see, the first and largely unargued premise of McDowell's book. McDowell is a devoted reader of Sellars, Davidson, and Brandom, and is fully aware of the possibility of what he calls, quote, a frame of mind that makes it hard to see how experience could function as a tribunal, delivering verdicts on thinking, on our thinking. He sees these three philosophers as so infatuated with the need to repudiate the myth of the given, to avoid the British empiricists' traditional confusion of causation with justification, as to be willing to give up world-directedness and rational answerability to the world. McDowell develops his account of how these three demythologizing philosophers fell into error by distinguishing between the logical space of nature and the logical space of reason. The former he defines as the logical space in which the natural sciences function as we have been able to conceive them by a well-charted and in itself admirable development of modern thought. He uses the term the realm of law as a synonym for the logical space of nature, and often states the problem raised by abandoning the myth of the given as that of understanding the relation between the realm of law and the realm of reason. As McDowell sees it, Sellars and Davidson are so impressed by nature as described by physics, the realm of law as the realm of atoms and void, that they feel impelled to give an account of experience which, quote, disqualifies it from intelligibly constituting a tribunal. For these purposes, McDowell says, quote, Sellars and Davidson are interchangeable. Sellars' attack on the given corresponds to Davidson's attack on what he calls the third dogma of empiricism, the dualism of conceptual scheme and empirical content. Sellars and Davidson both think, end of quote, Sellars and Davidson both think that adopting psychological nominalism and thereby avoiding a confusion between justification and causation entails claiming that only a belief can justify a belief. Only a judgment can justify a judgment. This means drawing a sharp line between experience as cause of the occurrence of a justification, as when the belief, my God, I'm staring at something red, pops into your head when you open your eyes, and experience as itself justificatory. That is, the perceptual appearance that is neither the physiological changes in your sense organ nor the judgment caused by those changes, but a third thing. It means reinterpreting experience as the ability to acquire beliefs non-inferentially as a result of neurologically describable causal transactions with the world. There's something left out here. Forget that sentence. It doesn't go with, yeah. Sorry, I think I lost that up. One can restate this reinterpretation of experience. Let me figure out what I'm saying here. That sentence was okay, because I'm talking about Sellars and Davidson now. I'm not talking about McDowell. Sorry, I get confused. One can restate this reinterpretation of experience, that is, Sellars' and Davidson's reinterpretation of experience, as the claim that human beings' only confrontation with the world is the sort which computers also have. Computers are programmed to respond to certain causal transactions with input devices by entering certain program states. We humans program ourselves to respond to causal transactions between the higher brain centers and the sense organs by acquiring dispositions to make assertions. There is no epistemologically interesting difference between a machine's program state and our dispositions, and both may equally well be called beliefs or judgments. There's no more or less intentionality, world-directedness, or rationality in the one case than in the other. We can describe both ourselves and machines in normative programming terms or in non-normative hardware terms. No problem arises in either case about the interface between software and hardware, the intentional and the non-intentional, the space of reasons and the space of laws. McDowell regards Sellars, Davidson, and Brandom as renouncing empiricism because they renounce the idea of experience as a tribunal. Brandom and Sellars agree with Davidson that, as McDowell puts it, quote, we cannot take experience to be epistemologically significant without falling into the myth of the given, close quote. But McDowell thinks that this renunciation of empiricism simply will not work. He thinks that doing so will, quote, leave the traditional philosophical questions still looking as if they ought to be good ones, so the result is continuing philosophical discomfort, not an exorcism of philosophy. Like me, McDowell regards himself as a therapeutic philosopher. He hopes, as I do, to create, quote, a frame of mind in which we would no longer seem to be faced with problems that call on philosophy to bring subject and object back together again. We both want to achieve what he calls an intellectual right to shrug our shoulders at skeptical questions. And also, we both want, quote, to disown an obligation to try to answer the characteristic questions of modern philosophy, close quote. But McDowell believes, as I do not, that, quote, a real insight is operative in seeming to be faced with that obligation. That is, I think that once you see us as computers whose program states are called beliefs, that said, you are now rid of any temptation to answer the characteristic questions of modern epistemology. He thinks that there was an insight in which we had when we seemed to be faced with this epistemological problematic, which gets lost in this quick, dirty Sellers-Davidson-Brandom way of getting rid of the questions. So McDowell thinks that empiricism expelled with a pitchfork will return again through the window. He thinks that we can, quote, trace some distinctive anxieties of modern philosophy to a tension between two forces, the attractiveness of a minimal empiricism on the one hand, and the fact that all awareness is a linguistic affair on the other. This seems to me a very happy way to put the present situation in philosophy of mind and language. In McDowell's picture, the linguistic turn in philosophy helped us see that nothing was part of the process of justification which does not have a linguistic shape. That's his, as it were, concession to Sellers, or that's what he thinks of as Sellers' big discovery. It did not, however, take away what he calls the need to make sense of the world-directedness of empirical thinking. So long as the attractions of empiricism are not explained away, he says, the incoherence of the myth of the given will be, quote, a source of continuing philosophical discomfort. Crudely, one can say that when Wittgenstein or me or Derrida is called a linguistic idealist, someone who has lost touch with the world, what's being said is something like, these guys don't make sense of the world directedness of empirical thinking. You know, so it can be put as loss of directedness, loss of the world, loss of, I don't know, loss of all kinds of things. But it is certainly the case that this charge of linguistic idealism is a common reaction to lots of post-Wittgensteinian, post-Solarsian, post-Davidsonian thinking. It's Nagel's view of Davidson as well as of Wittgenstein, for example. In my picture, the linguistic turn in philosophy, the turn which made it possible for Sellers to envisage his doctrine of psychological nominalism, was a turn away from the very idea of human answerability to the world. I agree with Heidegger that there is a pretty straight dialectical line between the Cartesian quest for certainty and the Nietzschean will to power. So I think that modern European philosophy has, as Heidegger agrees, amounted to an attempt by human beings to wrest power from God, or more placidly put, to dispense with the idea of human answerability to something non-human. It involves what Heidegger lamented as forgetfulness of being. Like Nietzsche and Derrida, I think of such forgetfulness as a thoroughly good thing, and of what Heidegger calls the humanism of modern philosophy as an equally good thing. I regard the need for world directedness as a relic of the need for authoritative guidance, the need against which Nietzsche and his fellow pragmatists revolted, the need which I interpreted in Freudian terms as lingering respect for the primal murdered father. I suspect that our differing accounts of the genesis and development of modern philosophy provide the most fruitful locus of debate between McDowell and myself. But before returning to these accounts and to our differing metaphilosophical strategies, I need to sketch McDowell's own bold and ingenious resolution of the dilemma he believes to be posed by Sellers and Davidson's anti-empiricist polemic. To do so, I'll discuss three notions which are central to McDowell's thinking. One, bald naturalism. Two, second nature. Three, rational freedom. I had intended to give a simple exposé of these notions, but the exposé kept turning into polemic against them. So had I had time to rewrite, I would have separated these out more neatly. One, bald naturalism. McDowell sees, as I've already noted, a sharp dichotomy between the realm of nature and that of law. The bald naturalists are the people who deny this sharp dichotomy. They're people with reductionist instincts like Quine. Quine would like to think that the language of physics has some sort of priority, and that everything which doesn't fit into that language has to be regarded as a concession to practical convenience rather than as part of an account of how things really are. McDowell sometimes rephrases his dichotomy between the realm of nature and the realm of law. Not the nature-law dichotomy, but the law-reason dichotomy. McDowell sometimes rephrases his law-reason dichotomy as a dichotomy between two kinds of intelligibility, as in the following passage, quote, "The modern scientific revolution made possible a newly clear conception of the distinctive kind of intelligibility that the natural sciences allow us to find in things. We must sharply distinguish natural scientific intelligibility from the kind of intelligibility something acquires when we situate it in the logical space of reasons." That is a way of affirming the dichotomy of logical spaces, as bald naturalism refuses to do. In McDowell's picture, people like Quine, and sometimes even Sellers, are so impressed with natural science that they think that the first sort of intelligibility, the kind you get in physics, is the only genuine sort. Now, here I stop exposition and start a little polemic. I think it's important when discussing the achievements of the scientific revolution to make a distinction McDowell doesn't make. A distinction between particle physics, together with those microstructural parts of natural science which can easily be linked up with particle physics, and all the rest of natural science. Particle physics, unfortunately, fascinates many contemporary philosophers, just as corpuscularian mechanics fascinated John Locke. Quine once said, for example, that the reason that the indeterminacy of translation was distinct from the commonplace indeterminacy of theory was that differences in psychological explanation, unlike those in biological explanation, made no difference to the motion of the elementary particles. Nobody ever quite knew what he meant by that, but it sort of gives you his sense of how important the particles are. David Lewis, another example, thinks that all objects in the universe are gerrymandered artifacts except those elementary particles. Sellers himself was all too inclined to describe nature in Democritean terms as atoms and void, and to invent pseudo-problems about how to reconcile the scientific with the manifest image of the human being, instead of, as we pragmatists do, casually saying, oh, well, lots of vocabularies, no need to reconcile them. To guard against this simple-minded and reductionist way of thinking of non-human nature, it's useful to remember that the form of intelligibility shared by Newton's primitive corpuscularianism and contemporary particle physics has no counterpart in, for example, the geology of plate tectonics, nor in Darwin's and Mendel's accounts of heredity and evolution. What we get in those areas of natural science are narratives, natural histories, rather than the subsumption of events under laws. So I think McDowell should not accept the bald naturalist's view that there is a distinctive form of intelligibility found in the natural sciences and that it consists in relating events by laws, preferably nice mathematical laws. It would be better to say that what Davidson calls strict laws are the exception in natural science. They're nice if you can get them, but they're hardly essential to scientific explanation. It would be better to treat natural science as a name for an assortment of useful gimmicks rather than the name of a natural kind.
It would be even better to stop using terms like forms of intelligibility, for one might then avoid worrying, as McDowell worries, about whether, quote, what we experience is or is not external to the realm of the kind of intelligibility which is proper to meaning. If you are fascinated by the kind of natural science that does give you nice strict laws, you will be inclined to overdramatize the contrast between nature and reason by saying, as McDowell does, that the logical space of reasons is sui generis. I would argue that it is no more or less sui generis than the logical space of political argument or biological explanation or soccer or carpentry. All language games are sui generis, that is, they're irreducible to one another, if the test of reducibility is something like the discovery of material conditionals relating statements made in one game to statements made in another. But this sense of sui generis, the sense in which baseball is sui generis over against soccer, highlife, basketball, chess, and poker, is philosophically sterile. If we're trying to give philosophy Wittgensteinian peace, we should do what Dewey did, try to make all the traditional philosophical dichotomies look like overdramatizations of the banal fact that different tools serve different purposes. We should treat the fact that you can't use intentional talk and particle talk simultaneously as philosophically sterile as the fact that you can't play baseball and highlife simultaneously. We should not allow this fact to make us wonder, as McDowell wonders, how to, quote, bring understanding and sensibility, reason and nature back together. To sum up, McDowell thinks that we need to keep a big reason-nature-law-reason dichotomy in place, as bald naturalists don't. I think that both the bald naturalists and McDowell make too much of a fuss about this dichotomy and use it to engender pseudo-problems. One reason they make too much of a fuss is that both talk about intelligibility rather than about convenience. Quine thinks that particle physics gives us the one true paradigm of intelligibility. McDowell thinks that we have two such paradigms. I think we would do better to rid ourselves of the notion of intelligibility altogether. We should substitute the notion of alternative techniques of problem solving. Democritus, Newton, and Dalton solved some problems with particles and laws. Darwin, Gibbon, and Hegel solved others with narratives. Carpenters solve others with hammers and nails. Soldiers solve still others with guns. Philosophers' problems are about how to prevent the uses of certain words employed by some of these problem solvers from getting in the way of uses of the same or other words employed by other problem solvers. These problems are not posed by dichotomies between realms of being, but by cultural imperialists, people with monotheistic delusions of grandeur, such as Quine and Fichte, bald naturalists and bald idealists, so to speak. Second nature. If, like McDowell, you are concerned with the question of whether there is rational as opposed to merely causal control of human inquiry by the world, you will want to concentrate on the interface between the space of reasons and the space of nature and define something which can be described in both space as in both spaces. To make room for something of that sort, you'll need to say, as McDowell does, that, quote, we need not equate the very idea of nature with the idea of instantiations of concepts that belong in the logical space in which the natural scientific kind of intelligibility is brought to lie, close quote. McDowell goes on to say, quote, human beings acquire a second nature in part by being initiated into conceptual capacities whose interrelations belong in the logical space of reasons, close quote. Elsewhere, McDowell uses the analogy of being initiated into a moral community and thereby acquiring a moral character. The acquisition of a moral community and the acquisition of the ability to have perceptual experiences are both examples of what he calls initiation into conceptual capacities. Further, quote, such initiation is a normal part of what it is for a human being to come to maturity, and that is why, although the structure of the space of reasons is alien to the layout of nature conceived as the realm of law, it does not take on the remoteness from the human that rampant Platonism envisages. If we generalize the way Aristotle conceives the molding of ethical character, we arrive at a notion of having one's eyes open to reasons at large by acquiring a second nature. Reasons for believing, reasons for doing, and so on. I can't think of a good short, continuing the quote from McDowell, I cannot think of a good short English expression for this, but it is what figures in German philosophy as Bildung. End of quote. Having one's eyes open to reasons gives one the ability to be rationally controlled by the world, and thereby the ability to be in world-directed states and to have judgments which are answerable to the world. It also gives you what McDowell calls rational freedom. All these endowments become unintelligible, McDowell thinks, if we describe encounters with the world through our sensory apparatus in only the terms used by Sellars, Davidson, and Brandom. For the latter three philosophers, Bildung is a matter of intra-human relationships, the acquisition of the ability to interact with other human beings by asking for and giving reasons. The more gebildet you are, the more complex and interesting kinds of reasons you can ask for and give. But at no point do these three philosophers describe the world as a sort of conversational partner, offering you candidates for belief, nominations you are free to accept or decline. The world thrusts beliefs upon you, makes it impossible not to believe that there is something red before me, say, by causal interaction between the program you have internalized in the course of becoming gebildet and the state of your sense organs. It can also thrust a belief on you like, my God, my best friend is a spy, or something like that. I mean, that can be, just the idea comes to you as a result of walking into the room and, there's the belief. So for these philosophers, it is not felicitous to describe Bildung as opening your eyes to reasons for belief offered you by the non-human world. Describe perceptual illusions, the Miller Lion illusion, the woman with her head in a black bag, whom the unwary take to be headless, and so on, not as causing us to have true or false beliefs depending on our programming, but as presenting us with candidates for belief which we are free to accept or reject depending on our degree of intellectual sophistication. The difference between being caused to have true or false beliefs depending on our programming and presenting us with candidates for belief is the difference between lack of rational freedom and possession of rational freedom. McDowell likes to talk about the world doing you favors, showing you a kindness, vouchsafing facts. He says, for example, quote, the particular facts that the world does us the favor of vouchsafing to us in the various relevant modes of cognition actually shape the space of reasons as we find it. The effect is a sort of coalescence between the idea of the space of reasons as we find it and the idea of the world as we encounter it. Of course, we are fallible in our judgments as to the shape of the space of reasons as we find it, or what comes to the same thing, as to the shape of the world as we find it. That is to say that we are vulnerable to the world's playing us false, and when the world does not play us false, we are indebted to it. End of quote. Brandom, Sellars, and Davidson can all agree that the space of reasons as we find it is also, by and large, the shape of the world. Because most of our beliefs must be true, we can make no sense of the idea that a great gulf might separate the way the world is and the way we describe it. Unlike McDowell, however, these philosophers think that the world shapes the space of reasons not by vouchsafing facts to us, but by exercising brute causal pressure on us. Just as the brute pressure of the environment led to successive stages of biological evolution, so it led to the successive stages of cultural evolution. These three philosophers and McDowell agree that if you can't use words, you don't have conceptual capacities. To have a conceptual capacity just is being able to use a word. But the first three assume that since babies, dogs, trees, and rocks don't use words, there's no reason to think of them, these elements of the non-human world, as conversational partners. For McDowell, things are not so simple. He says, quote, conceptual capacities can be operative not only in judgments, but already in the transactions in nature that are constituted by the world's impacts on the receptive capacities of a suitable subject, close quotes. McDowell agrees that the rocks and the trees don't talk, but they don't just cause us to make judgments either. McDowell thinks of a perceptual appearance as, so to speak, a request to you by the world to make a judgment, but as not yet itself a judgment, even though the request has the conceptual form of a judgment. So the rocks and the trees offer us reasons to believe by, so to speak, borrowing our ability to use words, an ability they didn't have before humans developed language. That is, you know, the rocks and the trees couldn't be conversational partners before we became conversational partners and developed a second nature which, as it were, put us in rational contact with them. McDowell's impressions are neither physiological states which cause non-inferential beliefs, nor are they those non-inferential beliefs themselves. They are something in between the two, the ingredients of second nature. McDowell says that once we remember second nature, we can see that operations of nature can include circumstances whose descriptions place them in the logical space of reason, sui generis though that logical space is. This makes it possible to accommodate impressions in nature without posing a threat to empiricism. From the thesis that receiving an impression is a transaction in nature, there is now no good inference to the conclusion drawn by Sellers and Davidson that the idea of receiving an impression must be foreign to the logical space in which concepts such as that of answerability function. In receiving impressions, a subject can be open to the way things manifestly are. End of quote. Third topic, rational freedom. McDowell says that responsiveness to reasons is a good gloss on one notion of freedom. But he continues, there may be philosophical puzzlement about how such responsiveness fits into the natural world. Humean compatibilists like Davidson, Dennett, and myself, people who want to dissolve rather than solve the problem of freedom and determinism, think that such puzzlement should disappear once we see that the tools we use to apply and change our norms are often different from those we use to predict what will happen next. To ad lib for a minute, I think of Hume's dismissal of the problem of free will as another brilliant bit of proto-pragmatism. And Hume says, look, we have a way of talking about moral responsibility. We have another way of predicting what people are going to do. How could these possibly get in each other's way? Why? How could there be any problem about these, you know, the fact that here we got two useful vocabularies? And as far as I can see, Kant added nothing to Hume on this subject. That is, when Kant said there are two realms, one of freedom, one of nature, one phenomenal, one not, this was just a very fancy way of saying what Hume had already said. So I think that philosophers tend to divide into those who read Hume and say, okay, so much for the problem of free will, and they tend to become pragmatists sooner or later, and ones who read Hume and say, hey, that can't be all there is to it, and they don't become pragmatists sooner or later. I don't know what makes the difference. Parenthesis. So we, Humean compatibilists, do not see the need to do what McDowell calls, quote, looking for a conception of our nature that includes a capacity to resonate to the structure of the space of reasons, close quote. But for McDowell, the notions of rational freedom, openness to the world, and answerability to the world stand or fall together. And so does the notion of spontaneity in Kant's sense of the spontaneity of the understanding. So also does the idea of empirical content. McDowell thinks that Davidson does not see that a merely causal account of our responses to the non-human threatens our empirical judgments with emptiness in the sense of contentlessness. Quote, if we are to avert the threat of emptiness, we need to see intuitions as standing in rational relations to what we should think. Let me read the footnote here. I say, Davidsonians like me explicate the Kantian slogan, concepts without intuitions are empty, something like this: linguistic behavior which is not interpreted eventually by reference to its causal interaction with the speaker's environment is not interpretable at all. In other words, we try to explicate Kant's notion of content and emptiness as lack of causal relations, presence of causal relations. That's, of course, just what isn't good enough for McDowell as an explication of this notion of empirical content. On McDowell's understanding of the term content, some uses of words to classify visible and tangible things, words such as which and bosh and phlogiston, turn out not to have empirical content. They're sort of pseudo-concepts. As we learn more and more about the world, the fewer pseudo-concepts we have and the more real, contentful empirical concepts. Whereas for us Davidsonians, you always have as much content at one time as at another. You know, you're always in just as many causal relations as you were before, though you may not be handling them as well as you could or will. As we make intellectual progress, we become more and more open to the world, so the world manages to fill our beliefs up with more and more empirical content, and thus, so to speak, tell us more and more about itself. Davidson, Sellers, and Brandom have no use for this contrast between uses of words which have content and uses which don't. As good inferentialists and pan-relationalists, pan-relationalism is a term I use in a lecture tomorrow. As good inferentialists and pan-relationalists, they think that all a concept needs to have content is for the word to function as a node in a pattern of inferences. All the words ever systematically bandied about by superstitious cavemen as well as by sophisticated physicists are on a par as far as content or a lack of content goes. Whereas McDowell wants to revive a version of Russell's idea that non-referring singular terms are only pseudo-singular terms, Davidson, Sellers, and Brandom, I take it, all want to claim that any singular term that has a use is as good a singular term as any other. Just because the notion of rational freedom is, as McDowell uses it, so interlocked with other notions which I have no use for, notions like answerability and content, I have no use for it. So I have to construe rational freedom as that funny thing McDowell thinks we wouldn't have if Davidson were right, that there is a merely causal, not rational, linkage between thinking and independent reality. But I find it hard to associate that use of freedom with other people's. I find it hard to associate this sense of the term free with the only sense of the term free Hume was interested in, the sense in which you're not free if there's a gun at your child's head or if you're under hypnosis, the sense of free we invoke when we ascribe moral responsibility. I also find it hard to associate it with Hegel's claim that history is the story of increasing freedom. It seems to me a specifically Kantian sense of the term freedom, one which we could discard if we were willing to abandon the Kantian dichotomy between kinds of intelligibility and to talk instead about techniques of problem solving. So much for the three McDowellian notions I've used as pegs on which to hang my account of McDowell's solution to his problem. The problem of how to avoid both bald naturalism and the view common to Sellers, Davidson, and Brandom that the notion of perceptual experience can simply be discarded. I think this solution is brilliantly original and completely successful. That is, if you feel the problem, McDowell makes the move that will solve the problem for you. McDowell is just the philosopher you want if you fear losing your grip on the notion of perceptual experience. He does a splendid job of reconciling common turns of speech, such as a glimpse of the world, openness to the world, answerability to the world, with a repudiation of the empiricist confusion between causation and justification embodied in the myth of the given. His conception of second nature is just what is needed for this job of reconciliation. He has indeed rehabilitated empiricism. But of course, I don't want such a reconciliation or such a rehabilitation. I think that most of the common turns of speech which McDowell invoked should be discarded rather than given philosophical backup. I see nothing worth saving in empiricism. I think that saving the notion of answerability to the world saves an intuition which clashes with Dewey's romantic polytheism, because it retains the figure of the world as a non-human authority to whom we owe some sort of respect. In his discussion of my views in his book, Mind and World, McDowell quotes me as saying that, quote, "there seems no obvious reason why the progress of the language game we are playing should have anything in particular to do with the way the rest of the world is." He rebuts this by saying that, quote, "is the whole point of the idea of norms of inquiry that following them ought to improve our chances of being right about the way the world is," close quote. I think that that view of the function of norms of inquiry will lead one back to the distinction between scheme and world criticized by Davidson, and to the notion that the progress of inquiry consists in an increasingly tight fit with the world. McDowell, who accepts Davidson's critique of the scheme-content distinction, denies this. He says, "the world that I invoke here is not the world that Rorty thinks well lost. It is the perfectly ordinary world in which there are rocks, snow is white, and so forth. It is that ordinary world on which our thinking bears in a way that Rorty's separation of viewpoints leaves looking mysterious, precisely because it separates relatedness to the world from the normative surroundings that are needed to make sense of the idea of bearing, rational bearing, on anything." Close quotes. My own thinking, McDowell says, makes this problem urgent, so, quote, "my refusal to address them can only be an act of will, a deliberate plugging of the ears." I, of course, think that McDowell has been seduced by an empiricist siren song, and that my deafness to that song is an example of hard-won intellectual virtue rather than the result of a perverse act of will. But I also think that there is very little neutral ground for the two of us to stand on while we debate our disagreements. In particular, I don't think that more rigorous formulation of the issue is going to help. For I simply can't believe that anything important could hang on saying, with McDowell, that we should lose our Kantian freedom unless there were perceptual appearances distinct from judgments, rather than saying, as I would with Brandom, that Kantian freedom, if it, insofar as there is such a thing, consists simply in being able to withhold an is claim and make a looks claim instead. That is, I take it Brandom and I share the view that if you can manipulate the looks terminology as well as the is terminology, you know, you're as free as you're ever going to get, and you know, all it takes. Cracker Barrel pragmatists like me always ask, as William James did, what difference to practice is this funny little difference in theory supposed to make? So I find myself asking how this nice clean-cut disagreement between Brandom and McDowell about the nature of looks could possibly tie in with the cultural hopes which led Kant and Hegel to write their books. I think one lesson we should have learned from the revolt against medieval scholasticism is that when philosophers start quarreling about whether there is a third thing intermediate between two other things, for example, in St. Thomas's De Ente et Essentia, materia signata is an intermediary between prime matter and substantial form, they have probably traded cultural significance for professional rigor. And as De Ente et Essentia is, you know, a marvelously brilliant, subtle solution of a problem which is not very clearly visible to many people. I think the same of McDowell's Mind and World. I can't get Thomas's problem into focus long enough to care whether there is materia signata. And I can't get McDowell's problem into focus long enough to care about whether there are perceptual appearances distinct from judgment. So my inclination is to turn away from nice, precise formulations of the issue about, say, looks, and to start talking in fuzzy world historical cum psychoanalytic terms about the need to bring mankind to full maturity by discarding the image of the fierce father figure. When I succumb to this inclination, I start using the kind of rhetoric I was using in earlier lectures and we'll be using again tomorrow. This leads me to seek out the passages in McDowell's book in which he offers his own version of world history. The most pregnant of these is his remark that, quote, "Our philosophical anxieties are due to the intelligible grip on our thinking of a modern naturalism and his suggestion that we should work on loosening that grip." I'm not clear enough about what this grip is, but I read this passage in McDowell as echoing similar passages in Gadamer and in Charles Taylor, two other philosophers who think that Aristotle grasped something important, something that we began to lose our grip on when corpuscularian mechanics made Aristotelianism seem obsolete. I also read it in the light of a remark McDowell made to me in a letter that a Darwinian tone pervades a lot of my writing. McDowell expands on this point by saying that my suspicion of pre-Darwinian ways of talking, quote, reflects a precisely non-pragmatist favoring of Darwinian vocabulary as the only linguistic apparatus that we can genuinely see as permitting us to describe reality, close quotes. See, that's, of course, a deadly insult to a pragmatist. I mean, you know, to say you believe a given vocabulary accurately describes reality, it's the thing we dread doing. I indignantly deny thinking that Darwin describes reality or even just us human beings better than anybody else. But I do think his way of describing of human beings, when supplemented, as Dewey and Dennett supplement it, with a story about cultural evolution, does give us a useful gimmick to prevent people over-dramatizing dichotomies and thereby generating philosophical problems. Darwin gives us an analogy between growing a new organ and developing a new vocabulary, between stories about how the elephant got his trunk and stories about how the West got particle physics. By pressing these analogies, we neo-Darwinians hope to fill out the self-image sketched by the Romantic poets and partially filled in by Nietzsche and James. In this image, our attitude toward the non-human is, as Heidegger lamented, one of Baconian mastery rather than one of respect. When we adopt that attitude, artistic and political judgments rather than scientific and perceptual ones become the focus of philosophers' attention. We get philosophers like Nietzsche, Ortega, and Heidegger rather than philosophers like Moore, Carnap, and Austin. This seems to me a great improvement. That is to say, I think that Moore, Carnap, and Austin got stuck on science and perception. Nietzsche, Ortega, and Heidegger didn't. Sellers and Davidson, far greater figures than Moore, Carnap, and Austin, didn't get so stuck on perception and science, but they belong to a tradition which seems to me has been stuck in that way.